This will be a tape recording of a talk given by Cora Louise Belford of New York City, New York. This talk was given at the Assembly of the California Northern Interior Area of General Service, held in Stockton, California, on November the 15th, 1975. At the time of this talk, Cora Louise Belford was an employee of the General Service Office in New York City, New York. The original recording of this talk was made by Bart Daniel of Sacramento, California, and this cassette was produced from an 8-track copy of that original by Bill and Diana Cross of Ashtree Fellowship Tapes, located at 4588 North Meridian, Fresno, California, 93726, phone number 209-229-8244. This tape was produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry this message, and members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape. The total playing time of this recording will be approximately 67 minutes.
I am especially pleased to be asked to chair this meeting tonight and to have the opportunity of introducing our speaker. Cora Louise B. has served as Secretary to the General Service Conference during the 2 years of my service as a delegate. And she spent this last full week in Northern California, about half of that time in the California Northern Coastal Area, has been with us in the interior area for the past several days. She's had a tremendously full schedule. I marvel that she's able to hold up in the spirit that she has. We're so delighted to have her out here, I suppose, that we just couldn't get enough, and we wanted everyone here to have an opportunity to hear her. Thinking back over this last year, Cora Louise probably has the unique distinction of visiting all five of our California service areas since last October of last year. And although I don't have the authority to do so, I think it would be fitting to bestow the degree of honorary Californian on Cora Louise. I don't feel at all as though she's a visitor. In New York, incidentally, during the meetings of the General Service Conference, she was lovingly referred to as our den mother. I'll never forget that. So it is with a great deal of pleasure that I call on and introduce Cora Louise B. of New York City.
Hi, everybody. I am Cora Louise Belford, and I am a very grateful alcoholic. And listening to Catherine read the long form of the 12 traditions tonight, when she got to the last one, I said to myself that I hope that I will not be spoiled by all my blessings, but will remain in grateful contemplation of the one who is responsible for it all. Because this past week has really been a remarkable week for me. Jack gave me such a warm and kind introduction. And as he was talking, I was thinking about an introduction that I received several years ago when I was invited to speak down in Tennessee at a roundup, and I was to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. And the girl who had met me at the airport, who was fairly new in the fellowship, was asked to introduce me this morning. And I really loved this girl, and she was perfectly marvelous, and I think she loved me. But I want to share the introduction with you. She said that last year, when she was brand new, she said, I was asked to go to the airport in Knoxville and get the lady speaker from New York. And I expected some New York floozy to get off the airplane. And she said instead the sweetest little lady that you would ever want to meet got off the plane. And that was our beloved Hazel that she was referring to. And she said, and this year they sent me to the airport again. And the floozy that I was expecting last year got off the plane this year. So you hear everything in AA, don't you? I remember that I had just returned from a trip to Honolulu where my daughter was living at that time. And I had on a brightly colored flowered Hawaiian dress and yellow shoes. And from that time on, I traveled in navy blue. Well, as Lady Godiva said, I am coming to my close. And there is no... I beg your pardon for that one. Really, there's no way that I can tell you, and I'm not going to try to tell you, what this week has meant to me. And I was thinking about it this morning as I was getting dressed, and I thought, you know, it's really remarkable that these people asked me to come and speak to them and talk to them about service when they really know so much more about it than I do. Because you are really our teachers, and being in your midst in the two Northern California areas this past week has been really a very great learning experience for me. And I think I go back to New York with a great deal to share with my colleagues in the General Service Office. I know that it's going to take a little while for this experience to sift out and settle down, so that I can make some, characterize it in some way besides just a little slice of heaven that all of you all have let me participate in. You not only have made me feel so welcome, you have made me feel like one of you. I don't feel like a visitor. And I am delighted to accept your offer to become an honorary Californian. And I'm ready to call up my husband and tell him to quit his job at NYU and just come on out here. It will be quite a come down to go back to reality, to washing the clothes and paying the bills and going to work every day. But really, those are the things that I got sober to do, to lead a normal life. And I don't think what I've been doing is last week is a normal life exactly. But it's the kind of thing that makes normal life bearable, these occasional high experiences of this kind. I'm very grateful to all of you. Thank you so much. Now, I'm grateful, of course, first of all, to be sober today. And then I am grateful that our co-founders, Bill and Dr. Bob, met each other by the grace of God in Akron, Ohio, 40 years ago this past summer, and began this chain reaction that's still going on all over the world of one drunk talking to another, speaking together in the language of the heart. And then, second only to my gratitude for finding sobriety in AA in the first place, has been the opportunity that the fellowship has given me to serve as a staff member at your General Service Office in New York. Our General Service Office in New York. It belongs to all of us. It belongs to the entire fellowship of AA. And what it really is, in my opinion, is the storehouse of the shared experiences of AA groups and members from all over the world during the past 40 years. The two-way communication that first began between the AA groups and members and Bill and has continued throughout these 40 years. if nothing else has happened this week, since I've been out here with all of you, I hope you are aware now that this office in New York is a place where real people, alcoholics just as you are, work in behalf of the fellowship, that it's not just a box number, box 459, but a real place with real people, and that our purpose in being there is to serve you and to provide for you the services that you need and want. And we can only do this if we know what those services are. Now, you send us messages about this through your delegate, but also we hope that you will write to us directly and personally, any individual who has a question or who has a suggestion, as well as any GSR district committee member or committee officer or delegate. We want to hear from you because the experience in our files that we share with groups and members all over the world is the experience which has been shared with us by other groups and members from all over the world. Now, as all of us know, we got our 12 traditions through the shared, 12 steps through the shared experiences of the first 100 AA members. And our traditions came on later in answer to problems that were shared with the office. And these came about in answer to those problems, not as high-minded ideals that were thought up by hard-nosed old-timers, but people who were really trying very hard to protect the fledgling fellowship and save it from being destroyed by its excesses. That's really what the traditions are all about. And then many years later came the 12 concepts for world service, when Bill realized that he and Dr. Bob would not be with us always, and that some structure through which the AA groups and members could continue to communicate their wishes and their desires and their needs to their General Service Board and their General Service Office. Now, the board, the office, and the conference are all service bodies. We are not a government for Alcoholics Anonymous. We have no legislative powers, and we certainly have no enforcement function of any kind. The 12 traditions are enforced by no one, but they are embraced by most AAs, most places, most of the time, so that we can live together in unity. Our primary purpose in the office and on the General Service Board and at the General Service Conference is the same as the primary purpose of every AA group, which is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And our primary duty, I think, is to ensure AA's future, to ensure that the AA groups continue to be there, existing in a state of unity, so that the recovery program can be shared among alcoholics. I had been sober in AA quite a while before this became a reality to me. Like any newcomer, my primary interest was in the recovery program. How did they do it? How did they stay away from one drink for one day, day after day after day? This was what I wanted to know, and this was what I was greedy to learn. And it was quite some time later that I came to realize that the AA program is all one thing, that the triangle cannot stand without all three of its legs, and that without the legacies of unity and the legacy of service, I might not have a recovery story to tell. And so when I think of the AA program, I now think of all three things and not just the 12 suggested steps of recovery. This is what I began with. This is what we all begin with. But if we think back, as I do so often, to my first AA meeting, and think of how many of the 12 traditions were actually being put into practice that night, and how many services were actually being performed that night, we will see what a contribution the legacies of unity and service made to our recovery, and that without them, without the AA group meeting in enough unity so that we are free to discuss the thing that brings us together in the first place, there might not be a recovery story to tell. I hope all of you will continue to be in touch with us. I hope if there are any questions that you have that you will write to us about it. But now I would like, instead of talking about the office anymore, to share with you what we in AA call our stories. My story, I think, is the story of the transforming experience of my life. And so I welcome opportunities to share this. And I hope that in the process of sharing this story of how it was, what happened, and how it is now, I will be able to express to you in any way at all, really, the real depth of my gratitude to our fellowship for making it possible for me even to begin the process of trying to become a different and better kind of person than I was. Because the kind of woman that I became during my drinking years was the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. I was destructive, irrational, and unpredictable. When I went to my first AA meeting, September 6, 1957, it would have been impossible for me to believe at that time that the day would ever come when I would be able to look back on those terrible years and accept the fact that for me, they probably were the necessary preparation for the kind of thing that began for me almost immediately upon coming into AA. I think I was the kind of person who had to go through the humiliating and painful experiences of those years if I was ever to be broken in will and pride sufficiently to be able to take a real look at myself and engage in some kind of self-confrontation. I am aware that this confrontation is still partial, but it has been sufficient as time has gone along to tell me what I needed to know so that I could stay sober one more day and learn what else I needed to know the next day about how to stay sober one more day and to try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I began to learn some things immediately when I came into AA. I learned that I can't and don't control anything or anybody, not even myself, by my efforts alone. I need help, the kind of help that comes from a loving God, as I understand Him, and the kind of help that I have gotten in this program from friends both inside and outside AA. I learned that I don't have to be a winner, that maybe the only times in my life that I've ever really won have been the times when I seem to be losing. For instance, when I lost the battle with booze. I learned that I have the right to be wrong. Sometimes it's hard for me to admit that I'm wrong, but I have the right to be wrong. I learned that I have the right to make errors in judgment and poor choices, that all people do this, that this is a part of being human, that we seek spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection, thanks be to God. And the only thing that I think would be really fatal would be if I should cease to care. If I should cease to be truly concerned and fully committed to the principles of this program and to the power greater than myself that has seen me through so much this far along the way. I used to puzzle a lot about how I could have been one of the lucky ones, why this blessing came to me. Certainly I did not deserve it. I had done nothing to earn it. And I was no more entitled to it than any of those people who may still be out there and still lost and still not have found the way. But I really don't pretend to understand the mysteries of divine providence. I only know that this great thing happened to me and that I am grateful for it beyond anything in my life. I actually began to drink late in life for an alcoholic. I wasn't a high school drinker or a college drinker. I was 26, married, and the mother of two little girls before drinking was anything but a very occasional experience for me. And when my husband went overseas during World War II, I used to get together in the afternoon with other war widows like myself, and we'd turn the children loose to play in the swings and in the sand pile, and we'd sit on the porch and share our experience, strength, and hope with each other over a few drinks. And I thought this was wonderful. And I wondered where this great and civilized and marvelous custom had been all these years. How had I missed it? And right away, I began to associate all experiences of fun and relaxation and relief from anxiety and tension with those times that I drank. And I began to look forward to that time of day when we would get together and have our little drink. I imagined that drinking meant something to me in those days that it did not mean to these other women. But I don't think it would have made any difference to me, even if I had known that at the time. Because as long as I was able to handle it well in fairly large amounts, I really didn't think about it. I was proud of my so-called hollow leg. I didn't know that I was going to need that hollow leg as time went on, that I was simply in training for using it way beyond its capacity. I had a few good years. I was trying to think exactly how long. I'm never sure whether it was 3 or 4 good years before the axe finally fell. When my husband came home from overseas, and I had thought that this was all in the world I wanted, when I had said goodbye to him in San Francisco in November of 1944, I thought if this war will just be over and if my husband comes back all right, the whole world is my oyster. I have everything I want going for me. I was young, I was happy, I had 2 marvelous children, I had a wonderful husband, I was in love, and all of life was ahead of me. And when my husband did come home from overseas, and he was healthy, and he was fine, and I was ready for this fairy tale existence to begin. And instead, reality began, rather than this fairy tale existence which I had been looking forward to. He had been with the 5th Marine Division. I had been at home with 2 children. We had had different kinds of experiences, and something had happened to the sort of perfect communication that I had felt we once had. We began to have problems, and before long we were having serious problems. We moved to New York very shortly after he came home from overseas, and we had planned to stay there 1 year. He was from Georgia. I was from Mississippi. And we would go home after 1 year. We have been in New York ever since. Now it will be 30 years this coming summer. New Yorkers don't claim me, and my southern family and friends don't claim me anymore, so I'm glad you'll have me in California. When we had been living in New York for about a year, and things didn't get any better, as a matter of fact, they got steadily worse, it was decided that I should go to see a shrink. At this point, I had never been drunk in my life. Drinking was not a problem to me and was not considered to be a problem by my husband. He had noticed when he came home from overseas that I had become a daily drinker, but that's all. He just remarked about it. He didn't criticize it. As a matter of fact, he joined me, and we both became daily drinkers. But we were not daily drunks. We weren't even occasional drunks. I had never been drunk, and so the reason for sending me to the shrink was not to fix my drinking problem. I was insulted that we had problems, but I was the one who had to go to be shrunk. This didn't really seem exactly fair to me. However, I did not like the way I was feeling. I did want to save the marriage, and I did want to be a good mother to these children, and so I was willing to put myself through this ordeal, and that's what it was. Because I'm not talking about an occasional visit to a psychotherapist. I went in the old-fashioned way, 3 or 4 times a week, every week, even in the summertime, and I did this for 9 years. Now, after I had been with this psychotherapist for a period of about 18 months, in what the therapist thought was successful treatment, and in what I thought was successful treatment, I'm not sure how my husband felt about it, but I thought it was pretty good. After I had been with him for 18 months, I went to a party one night, and I still think that I drank in the usual manner. And I drank in the usual amounts, only something very strange and peculiar happened to me that night. I got terribly drunk, and I had a blackout, and I was completely unprepared for either one of these things. I had always taken a very lofty attitude towards drinking, that if one could not drink well, one simply shouldn't drink at all. You can see that I had a long way to fall from my high perch. I had never heard of a blackout at this time. I had fallen down a flight of steps and landed on my head on a stone terrace, and I thought that I must have a concussion, and that was why I couldn't remember anything that had happened. I was too ashamed of the cause of the fall to go to a doctor to find out. But I did discuss it with the therapist. And this was the first and the last time that my drinking was ever discussed again. We never mentioned my drinking again. I told him what had happened, and in innocence, really, he said all the things I wanted to hear. He told me that this was the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally. And that in my case, he even thought it might be a good sign, that it might mean that the so-called armor was breaking away and that, you know, the treatment would begin to work very much better. But he did suggest that until such time as we resolved certain difficult problems that we were dealing with, that perhaps I should be careful about any drinking I did. And I agreed with him wholeheartedly that I certainly should be careful, and I had every intention of being careful, because I never wanted to go through a thing like that again, and I didn't. And so I started out being careful. And I tried every way that I could think of to be careful. And I tried every way that anyone could suggest to me to be careful. But the trouble was, even though I didn't know it, and the therapist didn't know it, and my husband didn't know it, and my friends didn't know it, I had already lost the ability to be careful. None of us knew that I had already crossed the famous invisible line that separates people who can drink from those who can't. Neither of us knew that the question of to drink or not to drink had already become the imperative factor in my life. Now, I don't mean by that I ever was drunk every day or even I drunk every single time that I drank. What I mean is that from that time on, the question of what to drink and when to drink and how to drink and how much to drink or whether not to drink, this motivated practically everything that I did. I could not have believed at that time that I had been licked by a thing like booze. And I most heartily did believe that if I could only find the key that would unlock the door and emancipate what the therapist and my friends referred to as the real me, this great girl that I didn't know that was locked up inside of me, if this could ever happen, that I would be able to put some order in my life again, and that in this order, drinking would fall into its proper place. Now, during this time, the next 7.5 years of this psychotherapy, and then another 2 years after that, before I came to AA, but during the next 7.5 years, there is no kind of help or therapy or advice or counseling that is available in a great city like New York that I didn't have. I was the most advised and counseled person that you can imagine. And I do not mean to put down the efforts of these people who were kindly and loving and helping people and who stood by me. And I think it held me up until I finally got to AA. I don't think I knew any of this at the time. I think the fact, however, that they did not lose faith in me and didn't give up on me entirely probably kept me from giving up on myself entirely, though I would have told you that I was a hopeless person. Obviously, there was some spark of hope, or I never would have gotten to the first AA meeting. So I set out on a search for this will-o'-the-wisp known as the real me. And I endowed this search with every ounce of energy and imagination and resource that I had, and it was considerable. I continued to look for it in psychotherapy for another 7.5 years. But it is not remarkable that the therapist was not able to help me with the drinking problem, since I categorically refused to discuss my drinking problem. I found out what he thought about drinking by discussing my brother's case with him. It happens that my brother was a bona fide alcoholic, and so I was justified in answering the question, and I learned that the therapist thought, as a great many people did at that time, thank goodness fewer think it now, that if you can resolve the underlying personality conflicts and difficulties, that, you know, people can drink successfully. I certainly bought this idea, and I clung to it with a really fanatical desperation. I searched for my answers in books and in study. I was always running off to Columbia or to NYU to take a course, to try to learn how other people had lived and how they had gained wisdom, but nothing seemed to apply to me. I looked for it in worthy causes. If you had an organization and you had a really dirty job that you wanted done, I was your patsy, because I would literally try anything, hoping that I would be able to get out of myself, as they used to say, and get on top of things and involved in something, and drinking would fall into its place. But I didn't find any causes that were bigger than this desire to drink, and so that didn't work. I sought for it in domesticity and home life. I've never given so many parties or such large and elaborate parties. Frequently the food was on the floor. And frequently I had no idea how many people were coming, because I would have begun the invitations when I was, you know, just starting to drink. And by the time I would finish them, I wouldn't remember how many I'd invited. My house had never been so clean since or before, because I couldn't clean up anything inside or straighten up anything inside. I thought everything outside had to be just so. Finally, I sought for answers in my religion, on which I had turned my back some 6 or 8 years previously, and I proudly thought that I was an atheist. But I was getting desperate, and so I tried again. But I had it all backwards, because I was trying to make sure that God knew what my will for me was, and I had to come here to learn that it works the other way around. And I even sought for this lost soul at Ebbets Field in the days when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. I was a great baseball fan. And in the summertime, my children went away. And then those few controls that I had permitted in my life at all were gone. And I thought if I had to get on the subway and go to Brooklyn and then get on the subway and come home from Brooklyn, maybe I wouldn't drink so much. And so I asked my family to go together and give me a season ticket at Christmas time each year, and they did. And I got on the subway, and I went to Brooklyn, and I discovered beer. And the beer vendors discovered me. And I thought this was so healthy. Beer was such a mild and healthful drink, and I was outside in the fresh air instead of closed up in the house with my bottle. And this was just marvelous, and my friends used to say at that time, everybody was writing a book then called How I Found God, and my friend said she's going to write a book, and she's going to call it How I Found God at Ebbets Field. At any rate, the beer vendors used to come by at the seventh inning the last time round, and they would leave me 3 cans of beer, and they'd say, heaven help you, lady, if the game goes into extra innings. And at the same time that I was looking in all these places, I was, of course, simultaneously and continuously looking for my answers in the contents of a bottle. And here I really did always find a key. Always. Only the door that this key unlocked was not the door that I was looking for, because it was the door to a Pandora's box. And out of this box came this destructive, irrational, unpredictable woman. I had heard, as I'm sure all of you had, about in vino veritas. And I thought this person who made some attempts at worthwhile living was phony. And the real me was very probably this creature that came out of this bottle. And I couldn't face this. And the chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the lives of all those people who were close to me by this attempt I made to live 2 different lives, one on a reasonable and fairly rational, constructive plane, and the other on the dark side. This finally brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the effort anymore. The gap was just too wide between this person who made attempts at constructive things and this creature who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned or kicked over every good thing she did. This gap was so wide that I couldn't imagine there would ever be a bridge that could span it. And so I concluded that I was some sort of no good freak, who had every kind of opportunity that a person could be given and still couldn't make the scene. And it was in this defeated and burnt out frame of mind that I showed up at my first AA meeting. Because somehow, by the grace of God, one day in September, a day like any other day, when I was drinking as I had drunk on countless other days, I had my moment of truth. I had this sickening shock of recognition that this is how it's going to be. It never is going to be the way it used to be. You're never going to be able to drink that way again. This is how it is. You're not going to be able to solve any problem you have unless you do something about the drinking first. And I was sort of sickened by the recognition of the helplessness and hopelessness of my situation. And I was so sick and tired of it, and I hated what alcohol did to me, and I had hated it for such a long time. And while these thoughts were going through my mind, I was in the process of walking to the telephone, and when I got there, excuse me, I dialed my husband's number, and for the first time in my life, said something honest and appropriate about my drinking. I told him that I knew I would be drunk when he got home, and I asked him not to be angry, but to bear with me one more time, because I hoped it would be the last. And then from out of the blue came the words that subsequently changed my life. I said, if you'll call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to give it a try. I don't even know whether I'm an alcoholic. I know if I am, it isn't my fault, but it will be if I don't try to find out and do something about it. We know it's helped lots of people with the drinking problem, and it doesn't cost anything, so what have I got to lose? And what an irony that turned out to be, because all I had to lose was all those things that I had been trying to get rid of for all those years. All those things that had been weighing so heavily on my shoulders that I had almost sunk from the weight of them. And I began to find instead some of those elusive things that I had been looking for in so many places for so long. Things like faith and fear and meaning and purpose in my life. My husband was absolutely stunned by this telephone call. He just said, yes, yes, why, of course, okay, fine, and hung up the phone. And then I felt great. I was right in the dead center of the universe. I had made a big decision, and I felt wonderful, and not only that. I had told my husband that I would be drunk by the time he got home. So I really owed it to myself this one last time. And so I began what up until today was my last time. And I have always said that I got to AA by the grace of God and telephonitis. Because after I had a few drinks, I got on the phone. And I began to call up all my friends and tell them the big news. And not one of them said, you don't need that. They all said, that's marvelous, but I wouldn't have dared suggest it. And we would chat on about it, and I would hang up, and I would call somebody else, and I kept on drinking, and by the time my husband got home, I was drunk, and there wasn't going to be any AA meeting that night. And when I came to the next day from my anesthetic, I was really beginning to have second thoughts about all this big deal of the afternoon before. And then my telephone began to ring because my friends were onto my ways. They knew I had been known to telephone them and have a lengthy conversation and remember nothing about it. So they called up to remind me about the decision that I had made. And so I was stuck with it. Now, this was a Labor Day weekend, and I was expecting company for the weekend, drinking company. And I already knew from my brother's experience and from a colleague of my husband's that you didn't teach people to drink in AA, that the idea was you were supposed to stop. So I knew I was not supposed to have another drink, and I didn't take one, but I suffered. And I let everybody know I was suffering. I was very noble and I was very tragic as I watched everybody drinking and having a ball while I drank water and contemplated an end. Of such evenings. And finally, the day after Labor Day, as my sister was leaving, she said, I don't know, honey, but you got to find a better way than this because we can't take it as it is. She left, and then the day had come. I had to go to the AA meeting. I was sick at my stomach all day long. I was terrified. I wasn't even sure that I was an alcoholic in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, because I hadn't done any of the kinds of things that I thought you had to do in order to qualify as an alcoholic. I hadn't been hospitalized as a result of drinking. I wasn't a morning drinker. I knew alcoholics drank in the morning, so I was careful to wait till noon. Usually didn't get up till noon either, but even so, I always ate something before I drank because I'd heard alcoholics didn't eat. So I would stand in front of the icebox and eat a half pound of Swiss cheese and then start to drink. I was not a binge drinker or an around-the-clock drinker. I had never been in any trouble with the law as a result of drinking. We didn't keep a car in New York at that time, or I would have been in trouble with the law. You can be sure of that. I hadn't lost a lot in many ways. I still had my husband and my children. I still had most of the friends that I really cared about, and I still had the price of the next bottle. You might ask, what was the problem then? The problem was, of course, that if I took one drink, the rest was unpredictable. Though as time had gone on, it had become more and more predictable. Because as time went on, if I took the first drink, more and more often I fell drunk, and I had a blackout and began this round of destructive and irrational behavior. I think now that the reason it was so difficult for me to admit that I was an alcoholic was that I was not at all sure that I could stop drinking. I mean, after all, I had had every kind of help you can name, and nothing had worked for me. And since I wasn't sure that I could stop, I was reluctant to admit that there was any necessity to try. Not only was I terrified, but I was sick with shame and humiliation. I thought that I was permanently broken in spirit. I learned, of course, that what was broken was not my spirit, but my will and my pride. And I learned later that they had to break because they never had learned how to bend. And I hope they don't recover ever from the blow they suffered that day. But I didn't know what was just around the corner, and I was bleeding and I was hurting then, and this was tough. And as we walked out of the house to go to the meeting, I thought, you have really done it now. Here we go, about to take a plunge into the darkness. You have lost your way. And of course, the darkness turned out to be better than any light that I had ever known. And the way turned out to be better than any known way. And I have to remind myself of that today, that day, that I thought was the end of my life, the end of any part of it that could ever have any meaning for me, turned out instead to be the beginning of a new and very much better way of life, the beginning of a journey that I have taken hand in hand with all of you a day at a time ever since then. My husband and I were going to a beginner's meeting at the old Manhattan Group in New York, which was in a pretty raunchy neighborhood in New York at that time. And when we got to the church, I said, I can't go in. I am too scared. If I ever needed a drink in my life, I need it now. And Lee said, well, don't take it now. Let's just go and see what it's like. If you don't want to stay, we'll leave, and then we'll get you a drink if you absolutely can't stand it, but let's go. And I said, but I'm shaking so hard. Suppose they ask me to fill out papers and sign my name. What will I do? He said, I'll fill out the papers and sign your name for them. There must be lots of people who are in the kind of shape you're in who come here, he said. And so we trudged into the meeting, and we sat down, and I sat with my head bowed so nobody could see my eyes, even though I had been 5 days without a drink at this time. And this man led this beginner's meeting, and he didn't say any remarkable things. He just laid on some of those AA home truths. And he said a few things that finally got my attention And from then on, I was able to listen and consequently to learn a little bit. And when I think of the services that were performed that night at that meeting, I think of this man who, with his AA wife, later became our closest friend. And I think that he didn't know when he went there to lead that beginner's meeting that night that he was going to say something that would change the life of one woman and her husband and her children. He only came there to do a job, perform a service that his group had asked him to perform. And he told me those simple things, like you stay away from one drink for one day. You go to a meeting, you eat candy bars, you drink coffee, you use the telephone, and I could not see how talking on the phone and going to a meeting, listening to people talk about drinking, which was the last thing I wanted to hear about, how this was going to do for me. What all those hours and all those dollars worth of treatment had not been able to accomplish. And I know I wouldn't have believed any of it if I'd read it in a book. But you know how an AA room is. And I did believe what I saw in that room. I did believe that you knew what you were talking about. Because I believed that you had been where I was and that you had suffered what I was suffering. And that if this had worked for you, perhaps it could even work for me. And after the beginner's meeting, we went downstairs in that building to the open speaker meeting. And to this day, it is the lowest bottom AA meeting that I have ever been to in my life. And the wife of this man who was leading the beginner's meeting was really upset about it. And she kept whispering to me as they were talking. She kept saying, I hope you'll go to a meeting tomorrow night. They mostly are not like this. We usually have some women speakers, and most of the stories are not this rough. All three of them were men, and all three of them had a Skid Row background. And I would smile and nod my head, and my poor husband on the other side, thinking, you know, he'd really blown it, said to me, well, maybe I shouldn't have brought you here. You never did anything like this. Maybe you don't really belong here. Do you want to leave? And I said to him, why don't you shut up and let me listen to what they're saying? Because this transformation had taken place. Poor Lee. He was absolutely dumbfounded because here sitting beside him was some creature that he had never met before. Very different from the lady he had brought to the meeting and the one he had known the day before. Because what was going through my head, not due, and no credit due to me, to be sure, no credit due to me. This was grace, pure and simple. What kept going through my head was, if these people can have had so little and have been so sick and have had so few reasons for getting well, if they can do it, perhaps I can do it. And a day at a time ever since, thanks to the grace of God and to the help of this program, I have been able to stay away from one drink. I have gone to lots of AA meetings. I have participated to the fullest extent that was possible to me in my own group and throughout the metropolitan area. I worked as a volunteer at the intergroup office and as a regular visitor at Towns Hospital in the old days when we still had it. And all of this was the most exciting thing that I had ever done. Because after years of vacillating between this frantic kind of activity and utter paralysis, finally I was able to do something which seemed useful, which had some meaning, and which was making a reality out of living for me. Now, I couldn't have done this except for the fact that people like you in rooms like this gave me the incentive from their example. And they gave me the tools of their experience. And they gave me the strength of their support. to be able to begin the process of facing the realities of my own life one day at a time, and a whole new world began to open up for me. I can't give thanks for all these blessings. I don't have the words. I never will. I've tried. And I know that this is inexpressible, and I know that you agree that what we feel about what has happened to us is inexpressible in words. And so for me, I've had to try to find ways to give at least partial evidence of my gratitude by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it, who were the ones who showed me the way. Now, I want to tell you one story before I sit down. I, in recent years, have always told this story every time I ever speak at an open meeting, because a few years ago, I was invited to speak at an anniversary meeting in New York, and I didn't tell the story, and the man who had asked me after it was over said, "Well, I never would have asked you if it hadn't been for that story. I wish you hadn't come," he said. So I always tell the story. It's not the worst thing that I ever did when I was drinking, and it's not the thing that has the most far-reaching consequences. But when I was first asked to speak at an AA meeting, I thought, I just don't have anything to tell them except that I drank too long, too much, too often. I mean, nothing startling, nothing dramatic ever happened to me. My deterioration was an inside job. It was not such an outside deterioration. And how do you describe it? And I need a story that will show what kind of life I had and what I did with it as a result of alcoholic drinking. And then I remembered this event, which I had buried as deep as I could, because I certainly didn't want to remember it. And that is that about 2 years before I came into AA, Lee had asked me if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and staff from his department at NYU. Now, my husband is a university professor, and he is also an Episcopal clergyman. He is a full-time professor, and he simply has a Sunday association with the parish in New York. Well, he wanted to have this party for the faculty and staff from NYU. So naturally, I consented to do it. I always consented to do these things. Of course, I could do it. Some people have sense enough to know they can't do it. They have sense enough to know that they will get drunk and ruin it, and so they just say no. I always said, "Why, of course." And I would have been insulted if anybody had questioned the fact that I could do it. Well, I could do the party all right. That wasn't the point. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had done the party. Everything was all ready, and the house was ready, and I was tired, and I was thinking it would be a good idea to lie down and take a nap before the company came. And then I had one of those inspirations that seemed to come with sort of depressing frequency to alcoholics. I thought, I'll have a nice little ladylike glass of sherry, and this will help me become drowsy, and I'll take a little nap. Now, I knew perfectly well that a little glass of sherry did not help me become drowsy. I knew it took several little bottles of sherry to help me become drowsy. And I also knew long before AA that it was the first drink, not the 10th drink, that got me into all the trouble. But I didn't know anything about how you stay away from the first drink. I thought I should be able to apply reason to this. And so I applied reason. And I said that any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this, and I took the first drink. And you know the rest. Only I didn't have the luck to pass out. I never did do that. And I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I never did do that either. I showed up at this party. And I showed up almost falling down drunk, close to hysterics as I always was when I drank, muttering a stream of what I hope was incomprehensible gibberish. Because most of what I had to say was highly uncomplimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that most people associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, we're Episcopalians, and Episcopalians take a sort of relaxed attitude towards social drinking. Nobody was relaxed about my drinking, which nobody thought was social. But the people at this party mostly came from temperance backgrounds. Most of them didn't even smoke. Now, these were the kinds of people that I call squares. And I called them that to their faces at the top of my lungs all night long. You talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, the hostess, a clergyman's wife, drunk and disorderly. And I had the nerve to refer to these people who were behaving pretty well in what you will admit was sort of difficult circumstances. I had the nerve to refer to them in what I intended to be insulting terms. Now, I've pulled off stunts like this all the time without drinking friends, and it was inexcusable behavior in any circumstances, but in this case, it was really unspeakable. And the day after this party, when I came to, my remorse was really spectacular. I wanted so desperately to be able to tell my husband that I was sorry, that I didn't want to be like this, that I didn't want to do this kind of thing, that I didn't know what had happened to me and I didn't know how to put a stop to it. And I wanted to ask him to help me. And I never could say such a word. I was so locked up in my miserable little alcoholic trap. And I was so involved in my own agony that I wasn't even able to tell this poor man that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know I was sorry anyway. I don't know whether he knew that or not. He certainly knew after this party that I no longer drank because I had personality difficulties. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. Now, you might imagine that I would have drawn some conclusions after a performance like this and thought that maybe, you know, I should stop. But I wasn't ready for that, and I didn't come to any such conclusion. I did decide that I had to try to do something about it, and I tried, with indifferent success maybe, surely more than I deserved. But I don't recommend my system to anyone who is new and who hasn't already tried it. Because I learned some new things about loneliness. I thought I already knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely with a fine husband and two marvelous children and what could have been an interesting life. The fact that I had all this and still felt as though I would die of loneliness only convinced me that I was a freak and reinforced all my feelings of failure and inadequacy. But after that party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing because I decided that I wouldn't do any drinking when other people were around. I had always been gregarious. I am gregarious now. But after that party, I didn't care very much about being around people anymore. I didn't want to make plans to do things with the children during the weekends or in the evening. I didn't even care if my husband sat and talked to me after the children went to bed at night. I just wanted everybody to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink in peace. But, of course, there wasn't any peace, because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. And that's what booze had done to me. It had made a prisoner of me. I was a lost soul in chains. And my chains may have been of the crepe paper variety, but in my opinion, these are the most difficult ones to break. And now, thanks to AA, I am no longer a prisoner. I have a choice. I can take one drink with all its consequences, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. And I no longer feel like a lost soul. Because even though I can and often do fail miserably in the fulfillment of my various duties and responsibilities, at long last my life does have some shape, some direction, some form. No goals. I used to think I had to have goals. But I know now that all I need is a way. And that the way will take me where I'm supposed to go. And the way that I have now is the way of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And these will lead me wherever I'm supposed to go. Now, I fall into periods of discouragement occasionally, and I'm always shocked at how quickly I revert to the old negative ways of thinking and feeling and acting. And I begin to kick the furniture and slam the doors and mutter curses under my breath and feel sorry for myself and wonder why I don't have more to show for all these great efforts that I make. You know, maybe you've done it too. But one time I really stopped myself. Because I was heard to say to myself, what is so different about your life anyway, except that you're sober? Except that I'm sober. Now, when I came here, the only thing in the world I was looking for, or even hoped to find, was sobriety. Everything else. And there has been so much that my cup runs over. I have found new joy in family life and in the happiness and well-being of my husband and my children and the rest of my family, my brothers, my sisters. I have found what it is to be a friend and to have a friend and to be able to look into the eyes of another person and see that person instead of just my own image reflected there. I've found that I can hold a responsible job, and I finally have one that I really love as a trusted servant in our general service office. I've found new joy in the practice of my religion, and all of this is gravy, because all I was looking for was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, I only have to remember those last 2 years when I drank alone late at night. When it always seemed to me that it was 3 o'clock in the morning and I was wandering through the halls alone, going down to get that one last drink. And I can remember that I used to say to myself even then that there must be some purpose in this. I must be looking for something that's been missing in my life. And even in my drunken confusion, I was right about that. I was looking for something, and thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you, and I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. Now, I'm not proud of the things that I've told you tonight. I don't think any of us is proud. I spent years trying to forget things like this. But I've learned here that I mustn't forget, lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA, and lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you all, and God bless you.